Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
You know, Dan, Americans crave candies. I only wish I could have indulged in myself. But I'm a diabetic, and it's impossible. But at the Fancy Food Show this July, one of the best gourmet candy and chocolate makers was Jason McRae. And he's here today to talk about his product, how he got there, and everything. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, first, tell us the name of your company, your website, and my first question is, how did you get into this business?
Oh, sure. So the name of the company is McRae's Candies, and the website is McRae'sCandies.com. I guess how I started. Sure.
Yes.
So it's spelled McRae's Candies.com.
That's great.
And it started really just, I was trained in biology and chemistry, and I did that for a long time, and then I gradually went to statistics and database design for a big, big multinational company, which got bought and moved out of Boston. I didn't want to leave. So that kind of left me with an opportunity to think about what I wanted to do with myself. I'm a candy fiend. I love candy, and I started messing around in my kitchen. Really, that's kind of how it started, just with a recipe that I tweaked, played around with. I thought it was better than anything I could buy. And then I started giving it to my kids' teachers. So that's kind of how it began, really just as a crazy idea. And then I couldn't make it fast enough, so I started charging more and more to try and control demand a little bit, and then I thought maybe I should write a business plan, which I did, and did a cash flow projection to see kind of what this would really, what the mechanics would look like if this was to be something I would actually do. And that's kind of how it started about 7 years ago.
Well, in 7 years, do you have a retail operation, or are you all on the internet?
So in that 7 years, we've really embraced manufacturing, so we do our own manufacturing. So we do have a small retail location kind of tied to the factory, if you will, and then we also have a website, which we support through our manufacturing, and then we basically sell to other candy makers or gift stores or gift basket companies all over the country.
Dan, I know you're really interested in this subject.
Absolutely. Do you do chocolate dipped strawberries?
No, I don't. I really, all of our focus is on caramel. We do just 15 or so flavors of caramel. It's all kind of the base recipe, and then we tweak the flavors a little bit. So we don't actually play in chocolate too much. Although we play just for our own fun and for our own, you know, crazy ideas we might have, but not on a big scale, no.
Yeah. When I started in the brokerage business 40-some years ago, one of my first company was a little chocolate tour up on North High Street in Columbus, Ohio, and he was famous for his hand-dipped chocolate strawberries. And they were unbelievable, and I just I had to make up excuses to go to his store so I could get chocolate-covered strawberries and buy them for the whole family. So you're working in a very specific segment of the candy market. Now, here's the question. Is it caramel or caramel?
Well, it sort of depends. So if you want to say caramel, it sounds a little more it's got a little more cachet to it. But if I'm just talking quickly or I've you know, been talking all day, I'll just say caramel.
Okay. Okay.
That's the truth.
There's a place out in California in Pebble Beach where it's caramel, and some people say it's caramel, and other people say it's caramel. And the people who live there are offended when you call it caramel because it's caramel, because it needs to be a little more sophisticated. So, So you were trying to bribe your children's teachers, and you had to keep raising the price, so you bribed them even more. Was that the deal?
No. I was making teacher gifts at Christmas time it must have been Christmas 2009, actually, before this was really still in my kitchen. And then I couldn't make it fast enough, so all the kids' teachers were buying them as gifts and giving them to each other and to their friends. So then I started to raise the price a little bit to control demand. So really it was – and my kids were going to three different schools. So I had three kids. They were each at a different school. So I ended up that first between Thanksgiving and Christmas in 2009, I just made just tons of caramel in my house. And then I would package all up. And I would individually cut them and wrap them by hand. And then so after that season, that's kind of when I started thinking, well, like, maybe there's something here. Maybe this is something interesting, and I love doing it. It was a blast. That's kind of how it started.
So when you were working in your kitchen, and you decided that the demand was so high, you were going to raise the price because you wanted to see if you could dampen the demand. What happened?
Yeah, so that's just classic economics. Basically. You find out the price that makes the manufacturer happy, and it makes the customer happy, and then you kind of get that balance, and that's sort of where you can settle on the demand that I can handle by myself, and the people are still happy with the product that they get, that they still perceive value. Because you can't just charge anything; you have to be able to give them a product that's high quality that goes with the price that I was charging.
So when you raised the price because you were trying to slow demand, did it?
Mm-hmm. It did, yes. It did a little bit. Because in the very beginning, I didn't charge hardly anything. And then it was just, then it was crazy. But then I started to have a more reasonable, like, okay, let's actually look at this as an economic problem. And at that time, I didn't think I would go beyond Christmas. I was just kind of messing around, still having fun, which it was. It was really fun. And then in January, when I looked at sort of what was happening and what my other opportunities were, I started thinking, well, let's write a business plan and see what it looks like. Let's see who the competition is. Let's see what I can do to make myself different from the competition, what kind of market opportunities are there that I can take advantage of? What kind of demand is there on a geographical bigger area? I didn't really want to have a brick and mortar, and that was all incorporated into the business plan.
Mm-hmm. Folks, we're talking to Jason McCray, who was the chief caramel scientist for his company, making caramel candy. So let me follow, if I can, with another question. When you're doing on the top of the stove in your little kitchen, there's a lot of companies, a lot of individuals who have great recipes or formula. By the way, is your candy a formula or a recipe?
I would call it a recipe.
Okay.
You know, a formula, you can go online and find lots of recipes, and they're all fine. And then what I did was through trial and error, got rid of a couple things that I wanted to get rid of, and enhanced the flavor and enhanced the shelf life so that it was still long enough that stores would be happy with. So that was kind of all the work that I did.
So typically what happens when somebody makes a great pasta sauce or whatever, and they think they're going to start a business. So they say, okay, we go out and we get a business plan and we figure we can do this. And we show investors samples of our product and we get some money. How difficult is it to replicate what you were doing on a small scale in your kitchen on top of your stove to a commercial venture and maintain the quality and the flavor of the product?
For me, it was fairly straightforward. I was lucky that Caramel seems to tolerate scaling pretty well. And when I went for my stove in the house, then I went to a shared kitchen here in Boston where you can share commercial space and you can actually produce a product on a bigger scale. And then I was using bigger and bigger pans, so then I started building a jig so that I could hold the pan and scrape the product out with one hand while the jig was holding the handle and stuff like that. And then I went to a larger electric kettle that had an automatic mixing mechanism so that I could make even bigger batches. And those were still about 15 pounds, but the process stayed the same. So it was still a slow cook process, basically over about 80 minutes, and that stayed the same. So that's really, even though the scale has increased, the process is really the same.
So what is the batch size today?
Today the batch size is about 55 pounds per batch.
And how many batches do you do a day?
We can do probably 10 or 12 batches in a day.
Are you getting
that's
there?
That's a long shift. Yeah, we do. We did that last fall. That's a long shift, but it can be done, and it was fine. You know, we talked about it. We realized that we crossed over the 10 batch threshold and went to 12, and like, wow, that was okay. We can do that, and so that's kind of cool because then you find out where your bottlenecks are, and you can fix those bottlenecks and like, okay, what do people need to do? Okay, I see. And you tweak those things. And so what I found is as you scale gradually, that's what I think has worked well for us. Instead of having a big jump in scalability where your bottlenecks can appear as a surprise, you can scale gradually and slowly, and then you can accommodate the bottlenecks as you go.
I want to jump in here, Jason, and ask a question. What made you decide to go to a building and then a retail operation?
Well, really, the retail operation is a very small, relatively small component of what we do. So we really stay as manufacturers, but then we have like, it's almost like a factory outlet. So people can come in, they know what we're doing in that building, and they, you know, the people from the neighborhood, oh, hey, cool, it smells great outside today, and they'll want to come in and see what we're up to. So then we can sell product right from there. So it's pretty small, but is that what you mean by retail? Because then what we do is, as a manufacturer, I always wanted to increase the geographic size of our reach. So that means you wholesale to other retailers and you leverage their brick and mortar footprint and their customers that are loyal to them, and you just provide a great product for them. So that's kind of how we wanted to approach the retail part of it.
So do you private label?
Not too much, no. A little bit, but not a ton.
So they sell your product under the McRae name?
That's correct, yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly the stuff you would see on the website, but then you can buy it in stores too.
Well, but then get back to my original question. What made you decide? Did you buy the building or do you rent it? And what made you decide to make that big step?
Oh, okay. So we're renting the space we have now, and I do kind of go back and forth with my accountant, the advantages of buying a building or renting a building, and it always kind of falls on, I think I like renting commercial space, at least for now. So that's you know, it just made more sense. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Okay. Dan and I have more questions, but first we have to have a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back with Jason McCray.
Life, it's made up of the simple day-to-day moments that keep us all running on full of joy, passion, and restlessness. It's singing full on to your car radio with the windows wide open. It's a whole bunch of early morning rush hours and a few late night runs for Rocky Road. It's full of pit stops and drive-thrus. It's life, and we live it between fill-ups at Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at valerocleangas.com.
We're back here with Jason McCray. Dan, another question from you?
Absolutely. So, Jason, right now you're producing about 55 pounds a day, or 55 pounds a batch?
A batch, and probably around a few hundred pounds every day.
Okay, so you're running like 3 or 4 batches a day.
Yeah, 4 to 6, sometimes to 8.
And so how many people do you have working for you?
16, 17.
And how many of those are involved in actual producing the caramel?
So the kitchen crew is about, 4 people in the kitchen, and then the rest of the crew is either sales, or I have some PR, and then I have a packaging crew as well.
So when you, as I've watched my wife make caramel all over the years, she always did it in a glass pan and let it cool. Then she would cut it with a knife and then take out individual pieces and wrap them in wax paper. So is your candy wrapped by machine or by hand?
It's wrapped by machine now. We use an old antique Model K made in Springfield, Massachusetts. It's what you probably see in candy shops. It's like a taffy wrapper. So you put the caramel in one long rope, and then the machine cuts it and wraps it all in one movement. Cuts about 80 pieces per minute.
82 pieces per minute. And you have just one of those machines?
I have two of those machines, yep.
Two of those. Okay. So let me ask you a question, Jason. Have you asked yourself this question, where do we go next?
I have. And we do have a strategy, and it involves expanding our current operation into a bigger facility and probably making it a little more efficient. You know, we would like to increase some of our efficiencies. We have a few, you know, you're always going to have bottlenecks, so we can see where those are, and we'd like to get rid of a few of those. And the new space will let us accommodate that.
So a new building, so you're going to be renting another new building, or you're going to buy this one?
We're going to still be renting, yep, a new building, yep. It's nearby the other one, but it's the same kind of idea. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of space do you have right now? How many square feet?
So right now we're in about 4,000 square feet, and the new space would be about 3 times that.
12,000?
Yeah.
So given 12,000 square feet, assuming you can find the candy wrapping machines, mm-hmm. What's the capacity of that space?
That's a great question. So let's see. Probably we could probably double or triple our capacity, I think, pretty easily in that space with the similar number of people and an additional investment in a faster machine.
Faster wrapping machine or faster mixing machine?
Wrapping machine.
Wrapping machine, okay.
Yeah.
So,
Dan, could I jump in here? Question and then go back to you, but you have the expanded capacity, but how do you intend to expand your sales?
Right. So what we do is we do a lot of wholesale trade shows all over the country, and then we also are working with a few trade, like rep groups in a couple different parts of the country that facilitate our expansion into a specific geographic area. where they're physically present, and then they rep us, kind of like almost like a broker relationship, but they're more like outside sales. So we've got two of those groups in the U.S. right now.
So, following Don's question, you believe then, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, I just want to make sure I understood what you said, that you believe that your expansion is going to come from, probably from wholesale relationships as opposed to the internet?
Yes.
And what percentage do you think of your business today is done on the internet?
It's probably 10 or 15%.
And is that a comfortable level for you?
I'd like to have it be a little more like 20%. But it's a little bit complicated because I also don't want to undercut my own customers. So let's say that I have product on the internet on my own website, but I also have a brick and mortar that is in some neighborhood. So I have to be a little bit careful to not do so well on the internet or price it in such a way that it makes the brick and mortar retailers makes their job difficult. You know, like basically I can't undercut their pricing.
Right. So you have some people who are gift people who incorporate your product along with other products in a basket. Then you have another brick and mortar distribution.
Yes.
Where you sell your candy to them in bulk, and then they sell it out of their candy store.
Yeah, well, it's either in bulk or we give it to them in the same product that you can see on our website. So we sell it to them at wholesale pricing, and then they sell it in those paper tubes like you see on the website.
Okay. And what are your most popular flavors of caramel?
Definitely the black lava sea salt. That's our number one flavor. And followed probably by vanilla and maybe single malt scotch. Those are kind of the top three.
Single malt scotch caramel. Whoa.
Yes.
Does that have any alcohol
cool.
in it?
It has as an ingredient, but then the temperature is too high and the alcohol blows off. But you have a nice aromatic, peaty caramel. We use Ardmore. It's a nice, rich, heavy scotch. It's a wonderful caramel, and it's really taking off.
Now, you know, I have to tell you, as a person who has a severe allergy to alcohol, I have had doctors tell me that, and I'm not being critical of you, that it is urban legend that if you heat up alcohol, if you heat up a liqueur with alcohol in it or liquor or whatever, that the heat burns off the alcohol. And I've had a number of doctors tell me not true. Some of it gets burned off, but you can't burn it all off. So the question I have to figure out is, am I going to be able to try that scotch caramel, or am I going to have to pass?
I don't know.
I
think it's worth a try. Maybe just one, like a piece.
A small piece. Okay.
I couldn't resist.
Okay. All right. I'll give it a try. We only have a couple minutes left, and I did want to ask you, you've mentioned now two times understanding the roadblocks.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of roadblocks did you find when you went from your kitchen to your first factory?
Probably capital. The big thing, I think, for a lot of small business owners is access to capital and also access to competent or good advice on how to spend it wisely and things like that. And that was something that was definitely a challenge for me.
So then once you got the capital and you went to the bigger space, did you find any more roadblocks?
Yeah, I mean, it always does come down to capital. Another thing was to effectively get the word out, you know, because we didn't really have our own brick-and-mortar store. We were really trying to provide a product to other brick-and-mortar stores. So then we changed our branding quite a bit, and made it so that the product was clearly high quality on the outside, which matched the quality on the inside. So then the retailers that were selling our product, they appreciated the design change to the branding. And that was kind of the second obstacle that we overcame.
It's been fascinating, Dan, but unfortunately we're going to have to say goodbye to Jason. Jason, tell us again your website and how people can reach you.
Sure. So the website is McCrae'sCandies.com, and that's spelled McCrae's Candies.com.
Thank you so much, Jason McCrae.
Yeah,
I know Dan's been fascinated by your Carmel, and I know my wife enjoyed it. So, we hope to have you on the program again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jason.
My pleasure. I appreciate it. Thanks, you guys.
Before you hear this or this or even this, before you turn a key, step on the gas and let it rip, before you get up and out and on the road, you have to be fueled by something. Make sure that something is Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. Small business funding is easier these days thanks to a new breed of lender called FinTech lenders. These internet-based lenders cut the time between applying for funds and getting the funds to just hours instead of months. They also make it easier to repay your loans, but their costs might be a little higher for their service. The next time you need dollars for your small business, try them. You might like the change. I'm Dan Perkins for Recalculating.biz and your small business tip of the day.
Our next guest, Dan, is someone I've known a long time and really appreciated. He was at Time Life. He was at Bloomberg. Then he took a career zig and is now doing something fairly different. PJ Boatwright is our next guest, and is here for two things: to tell about what he's doing and why he did it, and how it is to be on a new career at an older age. PJ, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Don. It's great to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing now.
Well, sure. So I started out my career as a writer for Golf Magazine. I was always a golfer. I played a little bit of college golf and came from a golfing family and was sports editor of my college daily newspaper at the University of Virginia. So that was sort of a natural. Didn't have any other good ideas when I graduated college. And after about 2.5 years of that, though, it seemed to me that if I wanted to rise up in the publishing industry, I would probably have to go into sales. Most of the publishers in the industry at the time had been in ad sales. So I made an effort to make a move from editorial to ad sales and was successful at it. I spent most of my working life in the media on the business side, most of it with Fortune magazine at Time Inc., as you observed. And that's where you and I met about 15 years ago or so.
Correct. And now you went on to Bloomberg, and then you made a change. What are you doing now, and why, and how is it working out?
Well, so I finished my career in the events side of the business. I was head of sponsorship sales for Fortune magazine's conferences, which are really wonderful conferences. But the media industry as a whole, and the magazine business in particular, as you probably know, has really fallen on hard times since the Internet came on the scene about 15, 20 years ago or so. And so I took early retirement from Fortune in 2012. An old Fortune colleague who had been in the Fortune's conference business, had led Fortune's conference business, was over at Bloomberg, and he offered an opportunity to me that sounded appealing. So I went to Bloomberg for about a year. And then an opportunity at the New York Times arose, and I went over to there to serve in their conference business. But it just became clear to me that at age 59, the runway for me was rapidly coming to an end in an industry that was shrinking. And if I wanted to keep being productive and useful, I needed to find something else to do. In addition to which, I was very tired of being on Metro North trains every day for about 3.5 hours a day and traveling about 50% of the time. So I worked with my college alumni association. I went to the University of Virginia, and they have a service for members of the alumni association, a career transition service. I contacted them, and they paired me up with a counselor. We took had phone conversations about once a month for about 6 months. She put me through a few standardized tests, and the whole point was try to identify areas where I would probably be successful, would probably enjoy the work, and wouldn't need another 6 years of school at the age of at the age of 60. And financial services came up very high on the list. So I started to study accounting. I enrolled in the Western Governors University's BS accounting program. And I started studying to be a chartered financial consultant and chartered life underwriter. So these were two parallel educational paths I was taking. And in the meantime, I was talking to people in both industries and trying to discern where I might be the happiest. And ultimately, I decided that financial advisory work was what I wanted to do. So I chose Edward Jones. I've interviewed with and researched quite a number of firms in this industry. And I chose Edward Jones, and I have been with Edward Jones since November of 2015, and I couldn't be happier with that choice.
Dan, it's all yours. This is one guest I thought you'd really enjoy talking with.
Well, PJ, I'm a registered investment advisor in my own practice. Not affiliated with any firm, and I've been in business 43 years. I've seen a lot of good markets and a lot of bad markets. When you were studying, did you consider the idea of creating your own independent company?
Briefly, it just appeared to me that, especially at my stage with really not much experience, to have the power of a firm like Edward Jones and its support, its analysts, and all its back office support behind me was really a better idea. And it's to me, that's proven to be true. I can't say enough about the support that this firm provides for its advisors in the field.
So how long is your commute now?
7 minutes. 15 by bicycle.
Mine's even shorter. It's out of the bedroom into my office.
Well, I've had that experience before too, and I agree. That's a wonderful thing.
Yes.
Where are you located?
Pardon me?
Where are you located?
I'm located on Sanibel Island, Florida, out in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well,
little tiny island.
Wonderful.
Yep.
Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. So it's we had 18 inches of rain over the last 3.5 days, but it suns out again, so maybe it'll start drying up. So
I'm sure it will.
At least you're not in Houston.
That's true. Although I felt like it as I was watching all the rain coming down for the last 3 days. So going with Edward Jones, you chose Edward Jones as to a major wirehouse because?
Well, there were a number of reasons. I do like the distribution model at Edward Jones. Every advisor, for the most part, at Jones gets his own office, ultimately, with his name on the door. We really believe in, the intimate, personal, one-on-one relationships at Jones. We don't even have an 800 number. So an FA like me will have clients of all sizes, and every one of them gets personal attention. We don't stratify our clients based on size. You know, with a lot of firms, as you know, if your accounts don't amount to a certain amount, then you get an 800 number to call. And I really liked that service model at Edward Jones. So, that Edward Jones wanted to expand in my town. I'm a W-2 employee. The firm knows where it wants to expand. So you might say that their goals and my goals intersected nicely just at the right time.
Mm. So,
where are you located, PJ?
In Southport, Connecticut.
I've been there.
Yeah,
it's a nice
Fairfield
town.
County. Very nice.
Are you the only Jones office in the town?
No, there are. So Southport is really a part of Fairfield. So I live in Fairfield. This office is in Southport. There's another Jones advisor in Fairfield. There's one just over the border in Westport, another town. I used to live in Westport. But, Jones is headquartered in St. Louis. It grew organically in the Midwest and has a lot of growth potential in the Northeast. So, that was one reason that the opportunity presented itself.
We should point out that the three towns that PJ just mentioned are amongst the most affluent in America. So there's a room for growth in that area, in my view.
There is room, you're saying, or there's no room?
There is room.
Oh, yeah. And you know, we're in all kinds of communities. We really started in more rural communities.
Right.
That's where Jones had its roots. Even in a community like ours, we're like a lot of communities. We certainly have on average, it's a more affluent community than the average in the United States. But, you know, not everybody is is on Easy Street here, and there are plenty of people that need help. And glad to be available.
I'd like to ask you, PJ. What are some of the things you learned from making this transition? Well, this is a program for small business leaders, but one of the things that's happening is a lot of people later in their career, 55 and over, are changing careers and starting their own small business. What are the things that you've learned that you'd pass on to other people in our age group?
Well, looking in the rearview mirror, I can say that one of the smartest things I did was get in touch with UVA's Career Transition Service. I mean, I'd spent a career in the media industry. I really didn't have a very broad understanding of what my options might be, what kind of careers might be available that would be suitable for me. Doing that research for me was extremely valuable. If I had been doing it on my own and just sort of ruminating about areas I might go into, I might not have picked financial services at all. I think really getting to know yourself in a research-oriented way, it's great to have anecdotal guidance and talk to people, but I took the strong preference test, for example, which was very helpful, and having the help of a professional counselor, somebody who's trained to help people identify career transition options, that was very helpful too. But I think anybody, I didn't realize that my alma mater had this service. I'll bet you mine is not the only one. I'll bet you your listeners, if they were to get in touch with their colleges where they went to school and inquired about such a thing, they'd probably find that a lot of them have access to something similar.
And was EDA just for the University of Virginia, or is it a separate organization?
Is what just for UVA?
You said it's EDA, educational.
Oh, I said UVA is probably
I'm
what
sorry.
I said. But one of the tests that I took was the strong preference test, which I found to be extremely helpful. And you have to take it, apparently. You can't get it yourself on the Internet. You have to take it through an approved provider, and that's where an organization like an alumni association or a guidance counselor at a college, they usually are the professional organizations that have access to that study, to that test.
Back to you, Dan.
But how much time do we have before our first break?
You got 4 minutes.
4 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, PJ, let's move to something more specific. What are you telling your customers today about the markets, interest rates, and what's going on globally?
Well, our advice is always tailored to the individual, and I rely on the analysts that we have in St. Louis. We have equity analysts, mutual fund analysts, economic analysts, bond analysts. So they serve up about 700 stocks that we follow and that we like a lot. We have high confidence in, and we have opinions written on those. You know, we also have about 250 mutual funds that we really like a lot, and as you know, those are all sold by prospectus, so I can't really talk about any individual ones of those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of the economy, a lot of people I find are concerned about the length of the stock market run, but, you know, we get a lot of research from the home office as well as some of our partners, and, you know, one thing that seems to be pretty clear is that this recovery, although a long one, is also a shallow one. In other words, it's been very gradual. If you look at the slope of the line of recovery, it's actually a gentler slope than most of the other ones that have taken place over our nation's history. So we don't think it's terribly overpriced. There's still room. There's still good buys in the equity market. And we think employment's strong, so we're still pretty bullish on the economy, and you know, largely we're a firm that believes in owning quality investments and having them properly diversified and reallocating as necessary and having a long-term plan. So we're not about doing a lot of trading and trying to chase returns. We're about having a good quality plan and sticking to it.
Sounds like you, Dan.
Yes. I have a similar philosophy that served me well for 43 years. I'm not trying to hit home runs. I'm trying to match the averages with a lower degree of volatility and risk. But that's a subject for another time. So do you think that the reaction that we're seeing in the market, some people call it the Trump rally, do you think it's a Trump rally because we've had a fundamental shift in the direction of the country where people are more interested in taking risk and in investing, whether it's small businesses or buying stocks of large corporations? Has there been a fundamental shift since Mr. Trump came into office?
Oh, boy, that's a deep question that I prefer to leave to our analysts about. You know, that's one that will be debated. You'll find people on both sides of that thinking this is a short-term thing or a fundamental shift. You know, I couldn't tell you. It's the same as with you know, the television programs today. It seems like, you know, I came from the news media, so you know, I remember a day when professional journalists were really valued for their ability to synthesize news. But today, you don't seem to be getting much of that. You get a moderator with one person who is taking a you know, one point of view, and one person who's taken an opposite point of view. You get an argument, but you don't get any synthesis. You know, it's. I think I'll leave that to the pundits to argue whether this is a short-term thing or a fundamental shift. I don't know, but what I do know and what I do believe is what Edward Jones believes, and what you just said yourself. I'm delighted to hear you've got the same point of view. It's through you know, good markets and bad markets, owning quality investments and having them properly allocated according to a long-term goal and you know, proper risk assessment is really the way to go. Our economy, the U.S. economy, is so resilient and so strong. You probably know this. I mean, the stock market went up during World War II, and that's probably not what most people would assume, but we have survived a lot in the U.S. Our economy leads the world, I think, will for a long time. We survived a civil war, 4-year civil war, and we'll survive just about anything that can be thrown at us, too. So that's, I don't know whether that answers your question, but
no,
I just have to
that's
say
fine. That's
music to my ears, but we have to pause for a moment to hear from one of our sponsors. And we'll be right back with P.J. Boatwright.
At Valero, we believe life gets lived between every fill-up. So whether you go down the road on two wheels or four, whether your Wednesday night is spent racing to the grocery store or down a track, and whether you're dropping off the mail, the pizza, the kids, or all of the above, we're here to make sure you're never running on empty. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
We're here with P.J. Boatwright. He's made a significant career change, and from what I've heard, he's really made he certainly knows how to do it. I'm going to ask him a different kind of a question. What in your corporate life has really helped you in your new profession?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, so that's actually easy, Don. I spent a lot of time in sales, you know, in the media business, and you know, financial advisory work is a very interesting combination of selling. You have to meet people and get them to do business with you. That's a big part of the job. And then the other half of the job really is helping people with their specific financial objectives and helping them reach them. That analytical piece, using the two tools in our case that Jones provides to get people on track to achieve their goals and keep them on track. So they're two very, very different skill sets. And I think that's one reason why, you know, this business is not cut out for everybody. If you're sort of like very comfortable in the analytical space but not very much with people skills and meeting people, then it's probably a hard business, and vice versa. If you're most comfortable with one side of that coin and not the other, it's probably not going to work out. You really do need both. So I think the sales skills helped a lot. And I also ran businesses, as you know, in the media business. I had P&L responsibility. So having to crunch the numbers and hit a budget helped me with the analytical side of this job as well. So I'm grateful that my Fortune magazine experience really equipped me well to make this transition.
Dan?
Yes, sir. I want to go back and talk to you about, as Don was talking about, the transition from one business to another. And you made an observation before the break about the news media. And I don't know whether you saw this headline over the weekend or not, but CNN issued a story that said, if you voted for Donald Trump for president, you are a racist and a white supremacist.
Yeah.
And do you think it's the role of the media to make those kind of statements? Or do they have a different agenda than when you were in the news business?
You know, I don't think, I'm not in the media business anymore, and I was never, except for briefly with Golf Magazine, on the editorial side. I don't really want to comment on the role of the media and that sort of thing. Our it's clear to everybody right now that we're going through a pretty divisive time in the country, divided time, a lot of heated discussions and differences of opinion. But we have been through similar periods in our history. I happen to be an optimist about our country and and the citizens of our country. I'm old enough to remember the civil rights difficulties of the 60s, this is in many respects comparable to that. So we'll get through this. We'll get to the next one. The media, you'll find. Some media being very balanced, some media being, having an axe to grind. There's a role for both. There always has been. I was also a history major. If you go back and read some of the things that were published in the media back in the 1800s about presidential candidates, it all seems like it makes today's commentary look quite a bit tame. So we have a long history of being hyperbolic in the United States, and that's okay when you've got a free country with freedom of speech and freedom of the press. I think our American public is smart enough to figure things out, and I'll just leave that at that.
Well, that's a pretty good answer. We're getting close to the end, Dan. Can I jump in with a question?
Sure, go right ahead.
PJ. You're in a unique position. You straddle the world of the corporate and the world of the entrepreneur, because someone once said that financial advisors like yours are really entrepreneurs. They just don't say they are. But what are the two or three things you've learned that you'd pass on to other people who are facing some of the same questions you are, you did, and apparently worked through?
In terms of being an entrepreneur?
Yes, going from the corporate world to their own world, to their own business.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a good question, Don. I worked a lot of my life in the media business in a satellite office. So I spent a lot of time isolated, working in alone in an office in Philadelphia. In Dallas, I was all alone. I only had an assistant, no other colleagues. So I think it's important for anybody thinking about going into business for themselves to assess whether or not they really have the motivation to do the job without any external encouragement, you might say. You know, I get up every morning now. I come to the office, it's me sitting here by myself, and I could do crossword puzzles all morning long, and nobody would be telling me to get to work. And it's up to me to have that internal motivation. So I always had it. That was never an issue with me. And I think anybody thinking about going into any sort of entrepreneurial work should really assess whether they've got that, because nothing will get done if you don't do it yourself.
Dan, you get to ask the last question.
So when I went independent, when I left Wall Street 25, 27 years ago, I sat in my office like you're talking about, and I said to myself, you know, I should have done this sooner. You feel the same way? Or were you just right when you made the decision to go to Edward Jones?
Oh, I have said that to myself many times. Many times. It's such a great business, and you know, I don't have the advantage of having worked with other firms in this industry. I'm sure there are plenty of fine ones. But it's something I wish I had done, you know, certainly in my 30s for sure. And what I'm hoping is that one of these days, I mean, I'm older. I'm 61 now. I'm not going to do this for ever and ever. I've got a 17-year-old boy. You know, I think it would be a wonderful thing if 10 years from now or so he came into practice with me and took it over one day. It's a great career. You really do feel good. You know, helping people, you can make a huge difference in their lives, and you know, that's very, very gratifying.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes look back. I did enjoy the media business. I did well in it. I was proud of the products that I represented. But at the end of the day, you know, I think about, did I really make a difference in anybody's life by selling them this ad schedule or that sponsorship? And I don't think so. I don't think anybody remembers fondly anything that I sold them in the media business. But, you know, in the short time that I've been with Edward Jones, I've had people, some clients come to me, you know, with genuine gratitude for the ways in which we've been able to help them. And that's, you know, you can't put a price on that kind of, you know, workplace satisfaction, you might say.
Right. Terrific. Thank you.
We're talking with P.J. Boatwright. How do people get in touch with you, P.J.?
They could call me. My phone number is 475-888-9386. And if you go on the Edward Jones website and search for my name, you can send me an email.
Thank you, PJ, for being with us and being so forthright about changing careers. And good luck in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Have a good day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Now, Dan, we're going to hear from your tip of the day.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. How is your vision? I'm not talking about your eyesight, but rather, can you see the changes coming in your business or industry? The ability to see what's coming can give you an edge over your competition. Industry magazines can be a great help to see changes coming to your business. You get the magazines because you belong to a group. Use the resource of your group or association to keep yourself current. You're paying for it anyway, why not use this resource? If you keep yourself abreast of what's happening, you will be able to make the changes to enhance your opportunity to grow your business. So here's your recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. The next time you get one of those membership magazines in the mail, sit down and read it cover to cover. You just might uncover a new opportunity. I'm Dan Perkins from recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day.
Before you hear this, or this, or even this, before you turn a key, step on the gas and let it rip, before you get up and out and on the road, you have to be fueled by something. Make sure that something is Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
I was just thinking, Don, as that commercial was playing in our discussion with Jason a few minutes ago about his caramel candy, we did a show with Dr. Chris Cates on August the 1st and his wine raisin product, which is the freeze-dried grapes and everything. And I thought, wow, I wonder if everybody got a chance to hear that show. So what I'm suggesting is if you didn't hear all of today's show or you want to hear our interview with Jason McCray, you can catch that off of our website. And if you want to hear the interview with Dr. Chris Gates on his wine raisin technology, that was on August 1st. So go to the website, recalculating.biz, and you can see previous programs and then go to Dr. Chris Gates and wine raisins and listen to the story. And you can listen to a lot of other shows just by going to the website. Don?
Yeah, well, what people should know about that is that they've taken the essence of wine that are beneficial for you and put it into a snack that gives you all the benefits of drinking the wine without any of the side effects. And if I remember correctly, you can even though you can't have wine, you can even use the product. Did I hear that right?
Absolutely. I can't have alcohol, so I'm between the getting my order of caramel and especially scotch-flavored I've got to try that. I've got to make sure there's got no alcohol. I should try one. And then Dr. Chris Gates' wine raisins is something that I am actually going to try for sure.
You know, Dan, for the next fancy food show, you got to come up and enjoy it yourself. I'm a diabetic, so I can't enjoy half the foods, but I think you would as well. As you know, I get some of our guests when I go to these shows, which are usually in New York at the Jacob Javits Center. Before we go, any last minute thoughts?
Well, I thought your Mr. Boatwright was a good interview in understanding that at 59, you can start over and start a new career and become successful and enjoy it, and which is something that you and I are both doing, and we're much older than 59. So I hope that was inspirational to some of our listeners who are thinking about starting over or starting a business in retirement.
Well, I agree with you there. PJ was one of the really good guys that I met in the publishing business over the years, and I was glad to get him on the show. And I also thought Jason McCray was a really good guest. I know you were enjoying the idea of the caramels. I only wish he had sent us along some samples, but that's for another time.
Right.
In the meantime, it's time to say goodbye.
Well, we enjoyed the show today, and we encourage you to go to the website, as I said before, recalculating.biz, listen to last shows, and we're also going to start giving you some heads up about who's coming in the future. And we thank you for listening, and we'll see you on Thursday.
Thank you for being with us today. From Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, If you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful